huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive, but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hello and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. It's producer Harry here to give you the introduction to today's episode. So today's episode is with Scotland's richest man, Jim McColl, OBE. Jim is an absolute fascinating man. He is someone who over the decades has built and scaled many different businesses in many different industries, and he's done this to a net worth of over £1 billion and become one of the UK's richest men and Scotland's richest man. So obviously, particularly in a very disruptive times like what we're currently in, you need to be learning from people like Jim who have an absolute wealth of knowledge, who have been through multiple recessions and been through everything in business. So finally, you can also watch the videos of these interviews on the official Rob Moore YouTube channel. And because we went all the way up to Scotland, we made like a mini little documentary, mini little vlog. So if you go to official Rob Moore YouTube channel, you can watch the interview with Jim McColl. It highlights the whole day of what we went through. So go to the YouTube channel, subscribe, and let's get on with the episode. But finally, remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
I want to say a huge thank you for taking time in your diary to my allow pleasure. Us to come and do the podcast. So we'll get started, very relaxed. I am fascinated that you are an esteemed company that only a very few people are in the whole world, which is, of course, a very high net worth, which is, you know, the kind of, you know, the billionaire status, etc. And I'm fascinated to know, what does someone who's got to that level know about life that us mere mortals haven't? Like maybe a millionaire, what do they not know that someone who's worth a lot more does?
I don't think they know anything. You know, I think you always have this mystique about, you know, if your business is bigger or you're more successful, it just gets, you know, you get more stuff. It gets more difficult to keep track of everything.
Sure.
And, you know, sometimes you look back and wish it was simpler.
Mm. Do you really, though?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Would you give it all away for it to be more simple?
I don't, what do you mean by give it all away?
Well,
I mean,
all the money, the responsibilities, you know, the companies.
I, you know, I really enjoy, and the day I stop enjoying getting up in the morning just to interact with some of the things we're doing, I will pack it in. Mm. But it's more the journey that's the fun. You know, I think a lot of people expect that when it's a destiny they're going to, but it's the journey that's the real fun and excitement of it all.
Mm. Do you ever sit there though and pinch yourself and go, you know, when I started all this, I started from ground zero, and now I'm in the Times Rich List in Scotland. You know, I think it's something like 80 something companies that you own or you've bought. I mean, it's significant.
We've bought a number of them. We're invested in probably at the moment 5 or 6 major groups, but they've each got a number of businesses in them, you know, so it's quite a number.
Mm. And you don't pinch yourself. You seem so relaxed about
it. No, I do from time to time, you know, because I remember when I started out, I mean, my real passion was sports cars and Formula One and all of that. And You know, I left school at 16 to do a traditional engineering apprenticeship. And I wanted to do that because what drove me to do that was I wanted to know how to strip these cars down, build them back up. And that was really what was driving me. So I remember lying under my car, which cost me £15, you know, and I had to repair it every weekend, side of the street. And I would read the motorsport magazine, you know, get in a cup of tea out of the cold to heat up again. And my real heroes in there were Jackie Stewart and Jim Clark.
Mm. And we interviewed Sir Jackie on the podcast, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been very a good friend of Jackie's, and I'm very fortunate to have been invited a couple of years down to his house to go into Grand Prix for the British Grand Prix weekend. Mm. And you know, it was last time I was there, I was pinching myself because I thought, you know, I used to lie out in the rain and cold, fixing an old scrap car up, thinking this guy was, you know, my real hero, and I've never dreamt I would be meeting him. But you, it's one of the bonuses, I think, of doing better in your business. You get to meet some really nice people and interesting people.
Mm. And did you intend to be this successful businessman and entrepreneur who owns lots of companies and is very well known in your whole nation, or was it just a journey that manifested itself?
Well, I think it's you take it in stages, because if you started out thinking about where you are just now, then I would, you know, you wouldn't dream it's possible, and people would think you're nuts anyway, and they do think I'm nuts. So you take it in stages. You know, at first it would be, I want a nicer car, I want a house, I want a nicer house, you know, and then... So just in stages, it goes up, and you work out what you need to get that, and then work back from that. You know, how do I achieve this? How do I buy this? And then work back and see what you need to do to get there. So that sort of drives you forward. But I think when you're starting out, if you're looking at the end, it's kind of difficult to take it on board, you know, to get your head around it.
Mm. So you said just in the middle of that people think you're crazy. Now, I interviewed another billionaire called Naveen Jain, who's the only person in the universe, so he says, to have a mining license for the moon. He's all about moonshots and, you know, he wants to get us off this planet quick. And he's a very big thinker. And he says, if people do not think my ideas are crazy, my ideas are not big enough. And that's a big statement he makes. And I did sense a little bit of warmth that came through you when you said people think I'm crazy. Are you okay with that? Do you like people thinking maybe you got big ideas and that kind of thing?
Yes, I do like people thinking that I've got big ideas. And I've been fortunate in a couple of the big ideas to demonstrate that, you know, when people said at the beginning, we'll never do that or you're crazy, to have done it, to prove them wrong. So, no, I quite like that, a challenge, you know, to go after.
And does it motivate you? Because some people are very motivated by proving people wrong.
Well, it's not specifically to prove them wrong. It's or to prove me right. It's, you know, if it's a goal I've got, I've probably thought it through, and I believe it is achievable, and I've got a plan. Yeah. You know, sometimes though it's not easy to get people to share your confidence about the vision. You know,
so. Would you define yourself as a businessman, an entrepreneur? Are they separate and two different things, or are they something similar?
I think they're very similar. I think the difference is you get a lot of people who are very good businessmen, and they'll talk about doing their own thing. You know, I'd love to do this, I'd love to do that, but they just won't make that step. You know, I've had lots of people come and see me. I'd like to have my own business. But they're scared. They won't give up. They won't give up the security of, and that's the difference. I think an entrepreneur will take the leap and believe in themselves. Mm. You know, they are going to achieve it. You know, when I finished my apprenticeship and I worked for a couple of years as a journeyman, and I then decided to go to university for 4 years. And I was earning a good salary by that time, and my mother thought I was crazy because. why are you giving up this good job that you've got a great trade? And I had to go into students' grants for 4 years, but I decided that, you know, I had to do that to move forward to where I wanted to go.
Mm.
And I knew I could do it and I could survive on it.
So do you have an appetite or an attitude towards risk then that's maybe, I don't know, a bit more carefree or a bit less concerned than a lot of other people you know?
No, I think sometimes it's the big risk is not doing something. Mm. You know, that to me is the big risk. You're not going to be able to move forward unless you take some risks.
Mm.
The idea is to do as much homework as you can to mitigate the risk. And that's what I'm really focused on with all the businesses I've got. You know, really understand the market, be the expert in the sector you're in, do as much as you can in learning about the competition, the markets, the products they're looking for, and then make the decision. You know, I've got as much information as I can here. You can assess the risk and move forward.
Mm. So sometimes with entrepreneurs, it's almost glorified the size of the risk they take. And it's almost like you've got to be losing everything or you're into your last. In fact, I think James Dyson was something for like 15 to 20 million in personal debt. And I sometimes think that story's a bit glorified. Do you think you have to risk everything? Or do you think that you can be a bit more less gung-ho and less all in? You know, they say all or nothing or go big or go home. What do you think?
Well, I think when you're starting out, I know when I started taking a bit more risk early on, I think you have to.
Mm. And I suppose you've got less to lose.
Because you've got less to lose. It's not as far to fall down. And you just justify it to yourself by saying, well, if it doesn't work, I've been here before, but you know, I'll do it again.
Yeah.
But I suppose as you progress and you get older, you know, you've got further to fall and it might be more difficult to climb back up again. Mm.
Does that ever make you worry?
I'm always worried. you know, it's very difficult to get to the stage, I think, where you don't worry. Mm. I mean, I think everybody does.
Mm.
Some people wouldn't admit to it, but, you know, it's scary.
Mm. And how do you deal with that? So we're at a little bit of a benchmark moment. I mean, it's a number, but I really felt it recently. So we're 3 staff off 100 in our offices. So we're at 97. Yeah. And I just got this realization, wow, there's 100 people in our office. We help pay their mortgages. There's the national insurance. We pay on them all, the responsibility. I love my team and I love being around them. But I've also got this sense of, whoa, this is real. And you get those moments sometimes where you're like, wow, you've got a lot to lose.
Yeah.
And how do you cope with that when you continue to grow?
Well, I think that's the real pressure. You know, you become responsible for more and more people. And I really feel a responsibility for them. And it gets to a point where it's not all about you anymore. You know, if you do something crazy and it doesn't work, that's fine if it's just you that it affects. But if you've got hundreds or thousands of people that are, you know, going to be damaged by what you do, then that becomes a real burden. And that's what would make you lose sleep at night, you know.
And how do you manage that? Because you've grown, I mean, it's thousands of staff your companies employ.
Yes. I think a way that I, and this goes back years, you know, that I get into the concept of, positive thinking to start with. I mean, I was doing a lot of traveling to the States and this is years and years ago. All of the bookshops we went into had books on positive thinking. So I've got a whole library at home of that. And then positive visualization and really having a clear vision, a storyboard for where you're going. So, you know, I've really focused on that side of it to create the picture and then use meditation. You know, when things are not, are maybe a bit challenging, can you just calm yourself down, learn to meditate and spend time working through your challenges in a calm state of mind.
Right. So is the meditation you do to completely empty your mind, or is it to essentially meditate on the challenges that you've got?
It's both. You know, it's first to empty it and then start to visualize this kind of positive visualization. And, you know, it's a lot of people worry about, am I meditating properly? You know,
yeah.
And I went through a phase like that, but on a trip I had to Thailand one Christmas and New Year, I met up with two Buddhist monks, an old Buddhist monk and a young one, to teach me how they meditated. Uh-huh. And that was a kind of breakthrough in just getting comfortable with what I was doing.
And what did they teach you?
Well, they taught me that it doesn't matter what you do.
Right.
You know, I thought there's some sort of magic technique, yeah. But it doesn't really matter. It's just the concept of calming your mind. You can use different techniques to do that, and then different techniques to do your visualization. And they both had different methods. And with both of them, you know, I think I was in a meditation with them for an hour and a half, and it felt like a minute and a half.
Wow. You know?
So that's when you know you are meditating. You know, so.
And of those techniques you learned, which one works best for you?
Well, just basically what I was doing before with a couple of tweaks from each of them. But it's what it's all about just calming yourself down and trying to focus your mind. You know, your mind keeps running even on, you know, if you've got things that worry you, it's difficult to get them out and you can't home in on them. You know, you've got to replace them, flood them out with something positive, something right. different. So that's maybe going back to a time that you remember that you were really euphoric and happy and kind of going through it in your mind, you know. Mm. And that kind of knocks out all the bad thoughts you've had, and it kind of changes your biochemistry and just the way you feel.
Mm. And have you been doing that for a long time?
Oh, yes, a long, long time.
And if you were to state the key elements of being successful, would that rank in the top things that you said?
Yes, it would. I can give you a story about something that really changed the way I approached the businesses. And it was, it'd be back in 93, I think. I just moved into a new house, an old sandstone one that we had to do quite a bit of work to. And then I saw on the market advertised a house that I used to cycle past as a wee boy. And it was, huge driveway, lovely big gardens. And I thought, I'm going to go up and I'm going to go and see this. So I said to my wife, I was going up to see it. And she said, don't be crazy. You know, you're not going there. We've just get in here. Stop it. You know, we're not going. So I said I was going up anyway, just to have a look. And I went to have a look at it. And one of these real fancy brochures, because it was an expensive house. There was no way I could have afforded it. You know, it was really quite well out of my range. So I took the fancy brochure back down to the house, left it in the kitchen worktop. I knew she would look at it. And I then said I was going back up on the Saturday to have another look. She said, well, I'll come with you, but we're not buying this, okay? This, you need to get serious here. So I went up, had a look at it, and I decided I was going to buy it. Now, at that time, it was before I bought into my first company of my own, and I was acting as a company doctor in a business where I'd agreed to take a small fee and a share of the upside, because I knew I wanted to buy in to a business of my own, but I didn't have capital, didn't come from a rich background, so I had no one to give me the money. I had to build up the capital, and the way I thought of doing it was acting as a company doctor, turning around a business that was in trouble, and agreeing to a small fee, so it's not a high cost for them, but a share of the upside. So we were about 3 months into our budget year, and I went back home after seeing this house, and I thought, what would I need to do this year for my share of the upside to allow me to buy this house?
Mm.
And I worked it back from there, and it ended up, it was about 2.5 or three times what the budget was for the year. And we're already 3 months in and you don't change the budget. You maybe have an update, you know, a reforecast, but you don't change the budget. But I went back, it was a company up in Aberdeen in the oil industry, and I went up on the Monday and I said, look, guys, got them all in. I've been looking at our plan over the weekend, and we're just way off the mark in what we can do this year. And we're going to change the budget. I know that's not normal, but I don't want that budget there because it'll still be in your mind. I want the new budget in. And they all looked as if it was crazy. And what I'd done with that house, I'd been up to see it two or three times. I'd walked around it. I'd touched the wood panelling. I'd touched the fabrics. I could go through it in my mind. I set what we had to have in the company and broke it back to all the actions we'd have to take. And I was absolutely on it every day, what we had to do each day. And also in the morning and at night, I would meditate walking through the house. At the end of the year, we beat the budget, the three times budget. And it made me, and I bought the house.
It would have been a rubbish story if I
went back to say that I was going to buy it, I had one other condition. I said, look, I need 10 months for the entry date. And the seller said, that's fantastic, because I'm going to move to Australia and I don't want to look at houses there until I'm sure I've sold this, because I need the money to buy the new house. So I had made this commitment. This guy was in trouble if I didn't follow through. And it was just this absolute focus every day on the goal, what we needed to do, and walking through in my mind twice a day. And we managed to get the house. Now, the big lesson I had from there was I was very happy with that first budget. And it made me think that very often we settle for goals that are well below what we can achieve. You know, we don't stretch ourselves enough. So that's what focused me in on really doing a lot more homework and testing of the addressable market, what our share is and the companies we're looking at. So where could we get to? And then set it from there rather than, well, here's where you are. We want to have a 10% growth and that would be great, or 20%, that would be great. Start from what you think is achievable and then work back how you can get there. So, it was a lesson on how you can, we underestimate what we're capable of.
Hi, it's Rob here, interrupting you with something you may not know. Something that a lot of people don't know about me is that I was one of the few people on the planet hand-selected by Facebook to pilot their new supporter program. Now, their new supporter program is rivaling Netflix and Patreon. It's a very small premium model where you can get exclusive content and advance notice or discount of new products and services. I felt really privileged that Facebook have selected me, one of only a few people in the world. So I wanted to make the supporter program the single best supporter program in the whole of the world. So this is what I've done for you. Not only can you get best discounts for any training that we might run, not only do you get notified first of any launches we do, we also do supporter meetups, supporter dinners, supporter WhatsApp groups where you have a deeper community. I do supporter only ask me anythings. I do supporter only content and podcasts. We have a community of 2,500 supporters, and I'd love to give you the chance to be one of those. I believe this is the best supporter program in the whole world. Find me a better one, but I don't think you will. So the link is bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R. That's bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R. We have done dozens of supporter events. So my supporters get 10% off the best price of everything. Someone just went in one of our WhatsApp groups and said, I've been paying $3.49 a month for just a few months and I just saved £800. That's like 10 years on the supporter program. These supporters are disruptive. They are going places. It's like being part of an inner circle mastermind membership. Now, you know I rarely run ads on my podcast, but I think this is so important if you want the best content. I believe the gap between free content and paid content is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. There's a lot of free content out there that's maybe not that good. And for just a few dollars a month, you can get the best content on business, on entrepreneurship, on starting up, on scaling up, on sales, on marketing, on the mindset of being an entrepreneur. So go to bit.ly/RobSupporter with a capital R right now.
And do you still use that kind of methodology, buying companies, other things that you want to attain?
Yes. Sometimes it takes a bit longer, or sometimes you get the wrong, you get down the wrong path, but that's just a message to tell you you're on the wrong path. You need, you know, you need to go somewhere else. Yeah. So this whole idea of just taking care of the stress, you know, by trying to calm things down, and it's not easy. Sometimes the pressure's quite high, you know.
Sure.
You got to work at it.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So that was question one. So something I'm personally, I love doing this. This isn't a job. This is brilliant. And I always put in a selfish question. I'm just being honest about that. I.e. one, not just for all the listeners and the watchers, but for me. And we've acquired two relatively small companies compared to our own over the years. But I feel like a couple of years we've probably hit, it feels like a bit of a ceiling in our industry where to push through it, just doing more marketing or more of the same stuff maybe is not going to give us that accelerated growth. And you, I believe from my research on your upward trajectory, bought a lot of companies, bought out competitors. And I'm fascinated by that. So I suppose, was that an intention? And then when you did it, how did you do it? And how did it work out?
Well, if I go right back to the beginning when I bought this company, Clyde Blowers, it was one of eight, the smallest of eight in the world doing what it did. And it was too small, really. I'd turned down the opportunity to buy it twice before the third time I decided, look, this keeps coming up. I'm going to do it. So I had done the research on the market, and we were at 3% share of the world market. And I thought if I could get to 15 to 20, that would be a good outcome. So I identified all the competitors, went to see them. Just to introduce myself, I'd bought this company over, you know, we're in the same business, seeing if there's any common ground, you know, that we could work together. I think there's an opportunity for consolidation in this sector. What are your thoughts? You know, just have the general discussion with them. I didn't envisage what happened. I eventually bought seven of the eight, including the one that I'd bought, you know, so I had six of the remaining seven. And I ended up, after 5 years, having spoken to them all, all except one, because one I was too small to talk to, but they eventually had to sell to me. I was very focused on face-to-face conversations with people, you know, just get into a discussion with them. And I ended up with 60% share of the world market and one competitor.
So you went from 3% to 60%?
In 5 years.
Wow.
But it was about not being threatening to them. I didn't go along and say, I want to buy you. I went along and talked about the industry, consolidation. And in a couple of them, they thought I was there to sell to them, you know, because they were much bigger. And I was here just laying the ground, you know.
Yeah.
For a consolidation that they would lead. So it was a softer approach rather than, you know, rather than targeting them to take them over. But that's what I've always found, that if you call someone up, quite 9 times out of 10, they'll see you and just go and have a chat with them and see where it goes. And then you can start forming your plan once you've assessed where they all are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, wasn't this one That wasn't it losing quite a lot of money when you bought it?
Yes, it was. Well, it's a lot of money, relatively speaking. Mm. It was losing, I think, about $250,000 a year. But when I thought it was too small because it was only turning over $3 million.
Right.
And in my experience I had as a company doctor, I usually found that you had to cut out some of the business. You know, you looked at the products in there are probably some that were loss making. You cut them out. There's not a lot of fat in there, you know, for a $3 million turnover to cut out. So I was looking at something, and this was my first company I was targeting. I was looking for something that at least $10 million turnover that I could work with. But when I looked at it, I found out that it had a share portfolio worth $2.5 million, and it had three properties on an industrial site that was the only industrial site right next to a retail outlet. You know, a retail centre, out of town retail centre, and it was obviously ripe for selling to a retail developer, much higher value. So by selling the property and the share portfolio, I was able to raise about $5.5 million. Now this company was listed on the stock market at the time when I bought 29.9% of it, and when I bought 29.9, it was valued at $2.5 million, and it had all of this value in it. And it wasn't until I looked at it that I could see the value. So I was getting $5.5 million and a company, you know, sold the property, sold the share portfolio, and I got the company for free, really, you know, and a bit of bonus and what I'd paid.
Wow.
So that was...
And has this all come about because of the experience you got being the company doctor?
Yes. You know, I'd gone to university, as I said, went back to work as a kind of junior manager to start with in engineering, and then sort of worked my way up. But at the same time, I'd done an MBA, and then a master's in international finance and accounting. And I was headhunted by Coopers and Lybrand at the time. This is before they merged with Pricewaterhouse. And it was to go in as a senior consultant to look at companies in trouble, and mainly industrial businesses, you know, because that was my background and I had the financial training. So it was ideal. But I really got some good experience in there. Didn't like working. I was only in there for 2 years. Didn't like that kind of role. I wanted to get into business of my own.
Mm.
But it was a huge learning experience and very good training from them on just how to analyse different parts of a business and what to look for.
Mm. And if you could give us like the top three things you learned.
Well, the top one that they told you was, if you can put the prices up, then that's the easiest way to make the company more profitable, you know. Yeah. And then a second one was, and the kind of business I was in was engineering and industrial businesses, to try and do a P&L for each product or each activity.
Mm.
And you probably find that there's a couple that are sucking a lot of money out of the company or losing money. Now, it may be that they are you need to do them to get the other stuff. Mm. But if you don't, then, it shows you where you can improve your profitability and save costs immediately.
Yeah.
So that's something that we've used quite a bit. And then I guess the third one is just the this whole thing about having a plan. It's amazing the number of places you went in to see and they didn't have a plan. You know, I'd be going in to see people that I would read about in the newspaper and get excited the night before I was going in. And then you'd come away from the meeting and think, surely it can't be that simple. You know, the challenge they had, to me it seemed that it was obvious what the challenge was. But I think one of my advantages, having done my apprenticeship and then worked on the shop floor, the first thing I did when I went into a business was go down and talk to people.
Mm.
And usually you find the answer there. And then you go up and tell the bosses what the answer is, and they think you're smart. Yeah. You see?
Yeah. Well, they're on the front line, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah.
They're doing it all.
So that kind of, that's worked quite a bit. Just speak to people in the business.
Yeah.
Further down.
Yeah. There's a common theme here, it seems, a non-threatening approach, and just talking to people and extracting information from having conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm.
And do you think that's done as much as it should be in the modern business world? Now we're all behind social media and email and everything else.
No, I think that's kind of taken over from people just getting out their office and walking to speak to people.
Yeah.
You know, you can see them sending text messages or emails and, you know, they're meeting an office across the way instead of just opening the door. It's why we've designed this with a big open area out there.
Right.
You know, people can just walk out and chat to each other. And I think maybe there's a bit of that missing now.
Mm.
And also with travel, I used to, if I wanted to meet someone in the States, for example, I would say, I'm going to be in your neighbourhood next week. Can I come and see you?
The classic salesman's line.
Yeah, and then once they said yes, I would then book the flight and see them.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't, you know, if they thought you were going to all that effort to go and see them, they wouldn't agree, you know.
Well, we find that because we've done now, this will be nearly 500 podcast episodes. It's quite a lot. And we do some on Skype if they're in America or whatever, but it's so much better when you get in the car and you go and meet the person face to face and you set up the cameras and we can get a feel for your offices, your space.
Yep.
I think there's more rapport than if there was a slightly laggy Skype connection. And
yes.
Yeah,
it's better. You pick up a lot more speaking direct to someone than you do even over Skype, you know.
I think a lot of people hide as well. I talk to people because I help a lot of entrepreneurs and they're like, oh yeah, I'll send them an email. And I'm thinking, no, you're just hiding behind that.
Yeah.
You need to pick up the phone and talk to them. We'll go and see them. And you know, you have some big problems, you go and see and meet the person that can remove a lot of the issues.
Yes. Uh-huh. You know, I remember when we bought a number of businesses from a company in the US called Textron. You know, they do Bell helicopters, Citation jets and so on. And it was a particular business I wanted. I had bought the business that I'd served my apprenticeship in.
You went back and bought it?
Yes.
Oh, nice. That must have felt good.
No, it felt quite good. And when I walked around the shop floor, there were some guys there that I'd served my apprenticeship still working there. And I remember one of them saying to me, he'd gone home and his wife had said to him, how come that guy's buying the company and you're still working down there? And he said, I said to her, I married you. You know, there's really good sort of banter and joking from these guys down there, and they, all you need to do is treat people fairly and communicate well, and you get a lot more out of them productivity wise. But it was a good feeling, and then I had identified a business that I really wanted that Textron had. It was the perfect match for it, but it wasn't for sale. So I just used the old trick, I'd like to come over and see you, you know, I bought this business, it's in the same line as one you've got, and I'd just like to share thoughts with you. And they told me it wasn't for sale. And then I went back twice after that, and eventually I was getting a good relationship with a guy, one of the vice presidents, and he said to me, look, Jim, I like having lunch with you and dinner, but we're never going to sell this business. Then he said the key words, the only way you would consider it is if you bought the whole division and there were three other businesses in it. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And he looked at me surprised, and I said, look, I've been looking at the other businesses you have, and they fit with the kind of thing we want to do. Now, we had raised a fund based on that alongside our own money. And as we got towards the end, the banking crisis was getting kind of bad. We did this in 2008, and we closed it 3 days before Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Wow.
But just coming up to the closing, 2 weeks before, someone, and this was a big deal, you know, this was in total about $1 billion deal. Someone who was going to pay me or invest $50 million asked me to go back and cut the price, chip the price. Now, one of the ways that I had got the confidence of this guy and the trust was I said, look, other private equity firms are going to come and give you this wonderful price. I said, they always chip it once they get in to do the diligence. I'll give you my word that if we give you a price, the only way we'll reduce it is if there's something obvious that you agree to that is different from what you told us. So they were asking me to go back and chip the price.
Right.
And then they said, well, if you're not going to do it, we're out. So I lost 50 million, an investor that was putting £50 million in 2 weeks before we had to close the deal. So I went over to see the individual I was dealing with in Textron. I said to him, you know, I told you I wouldn't chip the price. Well, I'm not going to do it, but I need you to give me a loan note for 50 million and I'll pay you back within 2 or 3 years, but you need to give me a loan note for 50 million. And I told him why. And there was a silence that seemed to last hours, but it was probably only a few minutes. And then he said, okay, I'll do it. And our lawyers, our accountants were helping us with the diligence, thought there was no chance we would get there. But it was the trips over, establishing the relationship with him. If I hadn't done that, he probably wouldn't have said, yes, I'll lend you 50 million. And he got it back within 2 years. So, and he's a very good reference to use if, you know, when we're doing deals with people.
How many companies, if you break them all up, have you acquired in your lifetime, would you say?
Do you know, honestly, I don't know. I don't know.
Wow, you must have done a lot of deals.
I'd need to go back.
Would it be 50, 100?
I think it'd be more than 50.
Yeah, wow.
It'd certainly be more than 50. Yeah.
Wow. And what I'm sitting here thinking is, how did you fund all of those? Was it just progressively buying bigger companies? Did you start with your own money? Did you do some sort of turnarounds? Or were you always just good at raising money in funds and from private investors?
No, well, the start was, as I said to you, I decided to build up some capital with this share of the upside on deals turnarounds I went into doing. They all worked. They were all successful.
All right.
And in fact, in the last one, they had to buy me out of the share of the upside deal because it was getting embarrassing, they said, for them. But so they bought me out of that, and that gave me the capital to buy into my first company. And then you're then growing your own capital after that, you know. And so we built up funds of our own. I took the company private, took it off the stock market, and probably from 1999 through till 2007, 2008, it was myself and three partners I had who were using our own money to fund businesses and maybe bringing in a co-investor alongside us. The model we had was we would put in 70% of the capital, get someone to put in 30%, and then some bank debt in, and that's how we funded them. And then to do this bigger deal, you know, the deal from Textron, we thought we'll go out and raise a fund. And that's when we went and raised some outside money to come in. But it was much easier, I think, for us on the deal-by-deal basis because you're not dealing with – I prefer to just be dealing with our own money, maybe one or two outside investors. But, you know, when you get into a fund, you've got a lot more and a lot more responsibility. And you need more people in – to manage all of that, you know.
And how did you move into doing that? How did you get your head round using other people's money?
Well, I in the last job that I was in that I spoke about, you know, in the when I was getting a share of the upside, part of the deal there in or the turnaround that I did was they had two different types of businesses involved in the offshore industry. And I decided that best to sell one and to focus on growing the other one. And I sold it to an American private equity firm. And they asked me to go on the board of the company in the States. So I would be over there at board meetings and getting a lot of exposure to the particular private equity company over there. And, you know, I was learning about how they did it, that how you set this kind of thing up, what the structures are like. And I'd been looking at this for a while before we actually did it. I tried, you know, we've listed two companies or three companies on the AIM market and then sold them because the market was, that was when I was trying to exit some and keep a stake in it, but have access to raising more capital. You know, the market's not always efficient, and quite often it can undervalue these businesses for no logical reason. And two that we sold, the last two that we sold, one of them, the share price was down at 18p and we sold it for 80-odd p.
Wow.
And it shows you how inefficient the market can be in valuing things. And then another one we sold for three times what it was valued at in the market. Mm. And it's, that's still a good fishing ground for good businesses, because they're quite often they're undervalued and they're small, so there's not a lot of liquidity in them, and you could maybe take them private. Mm. So it's an area that we look at as well for potential deals.
Yeah. Earlier on in that answer, you said, and I just want to check that this wasn't a thing, but you said there was a company and it was on the stock exchange and you took it off and made it private again.
Yeah.
Was that because you don't like having your companies on the stock exchange, or was that, is there, because, you know, some people like to keep their companies private, don't they?
Yes. Well, the reason was, you know, I told you that I'd done an MBA and then a Master's in Finance. In the Master's in Finance, we had a professor there who taught us about efficient market theory, and that the market's always efficient, gets things right. And I believed that up until 1997, when you had the Southeast Asian crisis, where the current, you know, the one by one, I think it started in Indonesia or Malaysia, and then there was a picture in the front of The Economist of the world melting. Everybody thought this was going to be a meltdown. So the stock market came way off, and our share price went from what it was to 25% of its value over a 3-month period. And, you know, at first this is a real blow to your ego, because you think you're pretty well off, and then all of a sudden you're only worth 25% of what you were 3 months later. And there was this company was growing well above 20% per year. It was performing very well. There was no logical reason. It was just market sentiment. Investors didn't want to be trapped in it was a small company, so they didn't want to be trapped in an illiquid investment if there was going to be this long downturn in the market economy. So we decided that, you know, we need to buy this back, need to get it off the market. And we paid at that time, and it might still be a record premium to take it private. We paid quite a significant premium, and we still got it for the fraction of what it was worth. And it turns out what happened after that showed us that even at the price before it went down, it was undervalued, because we made a lot more out of that by taking it private, building the continuing to grow the company. And that's when we started. We brought in a 30% investor, you know, and we started we continued to grow the business, which we couldn't do on the market, because you're not going to be able to raise money in a market like that. Or if you do, the existing shareholders, and of which we were probably the biggest, is going to be diluted. So that's why I went off the market. Then I thought AIM was quite good, because that was the main market. I thought AIM was going quite well, and maybe that was more efficient. But the same thing happened twice. So because I'd only floated maybe 25 or 30%, the company still owned the majority, then I was able to put them up for sale.
Do you remember the moment you found out when you were going to be awarded the OBE?
Yes.
Could you tell us about it?
Well, it was a letter that came through the post and it said...
most of us don't know what happened.
Well, you get a letter from, I believe it was from Downing Street, and it says that it doesn't tell you you're going to get it. It kind of says, if you were recommended, would you be up for receiving it? You
know, really?
And they're reviewing it. They don't tell you that you're going to get it at that time. So you respond and say, yes, that would be, you know, I'd be an honour to get that. And then you don't really hear much about it until closer to the time and they, you know, they come on and tell you.
And how do they tell you?
I think it was another letter that I got. I can't remember.
Is it got like a specific envelope? Like, you know.
Well, you can tell that, you know, that it's got it's 10 Downing Street in it. So, and it's at that time it was the Prime Minister that was recommending me for it.
Right. And did you read it on your own? Did you show it to anyone else?
No, I read it in my own first, and then I shared it with my wife. And we just kept it. Because they tell you not to, you know, it's worded in a way that you're scared to tell anyone because they might not give you.
Yeah.
You
know? It sounds very clever the way you do it.
It's very well done.
Yeah. Okay, now you've also got tons of business awards from all the research that we've done. So OBEs and business awards, what's your take on those? Do they make you feel fulfilled? Do they have no bearing on how you feel about yourself? How do you feel about awards and recognition?
No, I think, you know, I mentioned earlier to you that we had this organisation in Scotland called the Entrepreneurial Exchange, where it was all just entrepreneurs in it, and it was focused dinners where we would pick a subject like, acquiring a business or funding or something that was of interest. And those focused dinners were maybe about 16 people max, held once a month, and then we would have an evening with people and some bigger names along where you can ask questions just to share experiences. That was really a great way to learn, you know, from your peers and help the whole thing going forward.
Because I sometimes think awards should mean nothing because they don't change who you are. Like, for example, let's say you become a best-selling author. Well, you already wrote the book. The book is as good as the book is.
I know, but, you know, just to finish on the Entrepreneurial Exchange, they had annual awards. And the Entrepreneur of the Year was the big prize.
Right.
And, you know, we're all quite competitive. So you did feel really good when you got it. Mm. I got it in 2000. The gathering would be 700 people at the award ceremonies. But they thought, year 2000, we're going to have 2,000 people. Wow. And there were 2,000 people at the award ceremony. Yeah. And I won it that year. I was the Entrepreneur of the Year. So you get a bit of a kick out of that. And then I got the Ernst & Young Master Entrepreneur of the Year. So I think they do, they help kind of lift you. But the other thing they do is it's good for the team, you know, that everybody in the business, that they see that you're getting recognition for what you're doing, and they feel proud about the business because that's really who got the award, not me personally. You know, it's the team. I get all the credit for it, but they're the people that do the work.
Well, it's nice to hear that because I think maybe some people aren't honest about that. I think external validation for the work you've done is also equally on merit, maybe less so, but on merit as internal validation.
Yes. No, I think they're I think they're positive. You know, I think I'm not so sure about this rich list stuff and everything. You know, Although it does have its advantages because people read about it and you find you get invited to things that you wouldn't otherwise get invited to. You know, so it has its positive side. But I think, you know, at the time of the banking crisis, I thought it was a bit distasteful to be putting those things out, you know.
People do like to read them though, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Mm. But
and might I be so bold as to say that's okay for someone to say who's been in said rich list? It's like when billionaires say, oh, well, you know, it's not about the money, but they're already billionaires. What about us who want to make money or be successful or get in a rich list?
I think when you're in it the first time, it's just like getting the award, you know. But there's maybe more negatives come from it. Well, I think people do get jealous as they see you. Some people do as they see you rising up. And then, you know, you also, we're in Scotland. Scotland doesn't like, you know, this is the tall poppy syndrome. Scotland doesn't like people getting too successful, I find. UK is a bit like that as well.
Do you think Scotland's worse then or more like that?
Oh, well, you don't get away with that kind of thing here.
No. Because a friend of mine, Scottish, and he said that he will not have his wife give him praise publicly. He just won't have it. And he said he thinks that's quite a Scottish thing. And I just thought, wow.
Yeah,
that surprised me.
Strange. But, you know, it's funny. I don't think I've changed over the past, you know, since I was working in the shop floor. Obviously, I have a bit, but my values haven't changed. You know, I can't stand people who are not respectful to others, you know, and treat them well and so on. I just don't like that kind of bullying type of approach that some people get. You know, they think that if you earn a bit more money, it makes you smarter. You know,
that can often make you more stupid.
Yes. You know.
So do you think you're naturally humble or Scotland has kept you humble or both?
I would like to think I'm fairly humble. And I think it's just your environment and how you've been brought up. You know, I was always brought up to be respectful of other people.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, when I started out in the as an apprentice, I mean, I'd lots of other jobs like, you know, fitting tires, selling petrol and so on. And I always wanted to do my job really well. So I really admire people who have got that attitude towards their job. Doesn't matter what their job is.
Yeah.
If you're doing that, you know, if you're very proud of it, then that's equal to being very proud about buying businesses or making great businesses. I don't think there's a difference.
So this first question is leading into the second question. Do you mind sharing what the group turnover is of your companies?
I don't know what it'll be just now. With all the companies we're invested in, it be because we've sold a couple. So we're in the phase of buying, you know, looking at some more. It probably over $1 billion.
Wow.
If you add them all up.
And so my question then is, have there been some personal sacrifices you've had to make along the way from going from a chap who's passionate about cars and fixing them on the side of the road to £1 billion plus turnover?
You sacrifice a lot of your time, you know, your personal time. And I suppose early on, you take some big risks, you know, and I was always very focused in what I was doing. So quite often you don't take into account the impact it's having on others, you know, and the family and so on, and your wife, you know.
And what is that impact?
Well, you're being selfish, you know. You're kind of doing what you want to do, and you're not thinking of the effect it has on them.
Do you have children?
I do.
And did it ever affect the time you spent with them?
Early on it did, yes. But I'm very fortunate that later on two of my three work with me. Or, well, One works with me now. The other one ran one of our businesses that I sold last year. So I sold her with the business.
How does she feel about that?
Well, she's actually doing very well with the new owner. She's been given more responsibility and she's doing a great job.
Yeah.
And that's good for her as well, because very often when she was in here, I would be worried that people think she's got the job because she's my daughter, you know, but she's actually doing extremely well in under this an Italian private equity firm that bought the business. And she's moved up in that organization as well.
So was there a moment in your business career where you actually thought, wait a minute, I need to focus back on my family and not there be so much attrition of time around?
Yeah, probably last year. Yes, you know, I've maybe been too focused on the business. Because I enjoy what I do, you know, I love what I do. It's not business, it's just, like you said earlier,
it's not a job.
It's not a job.
No.
You know, it's something that I enjoy doing.
And is that therefore about being around people who understand that about you and accept that is you?
Yes.
Choosing the right people?
Absolutely. I think that's right.
Okay. We've got a few more quick firers now. Now you can answer them as long as you like, but if you also want to answer them as short as you like, that's also fine.
That would be better.
What's been your greatest failure and what did you learn from it?
Probably people, you know, selecting people is the greatest failure. And I've learned from it that you need to be a wee bit... Probably tougher early on when you find things aren't working, you know, you tend to give people a bit more time and try and work with them and so on. But it's better for them and you if you identify that early on. I would think that would be probably the biggest failure.
So is that about selecting the wrong person or is that just about not managing them well enough?
Well, it's a combination of both. Selecting it, in some cases it's selecting the wrong person in maybe one case it's about not managing them well enough, you know.
And you're a believer in addressing issues early.
Yes, I think you have to. But I do think I have thought up until recently you have to give people a bit of a chance, you know.
Yeah, because you can't expect someone to slot in and be a genius straight away, can you?
No, but sometimes, you know, time passes very quickly and you can get into habit. It can be habit forming and it's more difficult. The longer you let something run, it's more difficult to change the behaviour.
Are you money motivated? And if you're not, what motivates you?
Of course I am, yes. I think people who say they're not are lying.
Are you listening? Because, or don't have any.
Or don't have any. But I think, yes, I am. I mean, when I was doing my apprenticeship, I took other jobs at the weekend because I was money motivated. I wanted a better car. I wanted, you know, to do different things. And it just steps up.
What's your typical day?
I don't know that there's a typical day. I mean, I get up in the morning.
Are you an early riser?
I am. Like this morning, I was up at 3 o'clock, you know, but I went to bed early last night. So I just start doing some work on some of the projects we're looking at. I like playing about with numbers, you know, so I can spend a lot of time doing that. Today, coming in, I suppose it's fairly typical. I did my to-do list when I got up at 3 o'clock, so I had a couple of pages and I just started working through that. And of course, people come in and interrupt you, so you don't get through what you're doing. You've got to go back and do it. I need to be more disciplined that way.
Which I think we can all say, can't we?
Yeah. And then it's probably working till late at night as well. In fact, you don't really switch off. From the moment I get up till the moment I go to sleep, during the week, it's usually or for at least 4 days of the week. It's that's the pattern.
Mm.
And then I like to get home at the weekend and get a bit of sun and relax a bit.
Mm. Okay. MBA or real life on the ground experience?
Well, you know, I quite often get asked because I did my MBA and I did but the real life on the ground experience. And I think I wouldn't give up. I think the on the ground experience has served me more in doing what I'm doing than the MBA.
Mm. But would you change it or would you still do it if you
went back? No, I'd do the same because I believe all of this goes into your kind of subconscious and you then do things by gut feel, but it's not really gut feel. It's stuff that you've put in there coming to the fore when you've got a particular problem. And I'm sure there's lots of stuff in my MBA and the other degrees I've done that I just do automatically because it's in there.
Yeah,
and I don't know what it would be like if it wasn't in there.
Mm.
But I mentioned to you earlier about getting into companies, walking around, talking to people. I know people that have never been on working in that level are actually kind of scared to go down and deal with these people because they see them as different, you know, or in terms of the language and, you know, the buzzwords they use. So, you know, I think that on-the-ground experience is absolutely key.
Yeah. Okay. So we now have, we've about 50 episodes ago, we decided to freshen things up on the podcast and we've introduced a cheeky round.
Right.
So, yeah, we get mixed response. They've gone quite well so far, but these questions are a bit more cheeky. To be honest, I'm not, some of these aren't as cheeky as some other people I've asked. I asked one person his net worth and he shot me right down. But what I tend to do is get feedback from the listeners and ask questions that they like me to ask. So we understand you're a bit of a petrol head. What's the most you've ever spent on a car?
I think 350,000.
And what car was that?
Well, that was a special Bentley Azure that I bought in Monaco. And in Monaco, the cars are all more expensive because the tax system is different there. Everybody said it's tax-free. It's not tax-free.
No, you're just paying it when you buy stuff.
You pay it when, if you buy a big car, you pay a lot of tax on the big car. If you're in a big house, you pay a lot of tax in the big house. So it's indirect tax. It's not direct tax.
Yeah.
But you probably end up paying as much as you would, you know, but I paid more for the car.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you could, like, what's your favourite car that's ever been built?
I think the one I would like to have is a Bugatti Chiron, not the Veyron, the Chiron.
That's a machine.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Buy a few more companies. What was it you did for your house? You just need to
up the
budget.
I'll need to.
We should do that.
Get a bit more ambitious, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Now. You nearly, from my research, so correct me if I'm wrong, you nearly purchased Rangers Football Club in 2010, and we couldn't find out exactly why or what happened. Are you able to talk about that?
Yeah. No, I didn't nearly purchase it. What happened was Rangers Football Club had been taken over by people who were exploiting it and were out to kind of asset strip it, in our view.
Right.
And people from outside of Scotland.
Right.
Who, you know, don't understand how important both Rangers and Celtic are in Glasgow. Yeah. And I'm a Glaswegian, so we couldn't allow this to happen. It did a lot of damage, but myself and one other, a chap called Paul Murray, who ended up on the board, we decided that we were going to get rid of the people that were in there. And we held a special shareholders meeting. We managed to get them put out. We ran up quite an expensive bill. I wasn't a shareholder before all this happened, but I bought shares so that I could go to the AGM and the special meetings and, in fact, call them. And then when we finished, I gave the shares to the supporters club.
Right.
I gifted them to them and paid the hefty tax bill between me and Paul, and we got it back onto an even keel.
Wow.
But at no time in my mind was I going to buy it.
No. Although, well, I'm glad I asked.
I might think differently now because, you know, I was learning about this technique that was used in Moneyball, you know, and you know, do you know that's what's happening in Liverpool?
Well, I'm a Liverpool fan. The owners owned the, was it baseball club that Moneyball was filmed about? Yeah.
So it's the same technique they're using.
Yeah.
And I mean, you see 22 points ahead of everyone else.
Yeah. So buying these apparent misfits.
Yes. And just using this technique. So that's a thought.
Yeah.
In fact, we were approached recently to say if we were interested in looking at it again, the people who have invested in Liverpool would be interested in looking at it with us.
Ah.
And applying the same, you know, the same techniques.
Yeah.
So that's... Not that Liverpool, but it's nice to think about them being 22 points ahead of Celtic.
Yeah, yeah. Right, now, there was something that went around the UK and it did get under my skin a little bit because I'm very pro-capitalism and money. I think a lot of people who are anti it don't realise the good that a lot of philanthropists do, etc. And there was this bit of a campaign in the UK and it was on the major news, which is like, the world doesn't need billionaires.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, it probably doesn't need them, but that doesn't mean to say they're bad people. I've met a lot of nice billionaires.
Mm.
But, you know, it's just this thing I was talking about earlier where there's this tall poppy syndrome, you know, they don't like it. Mm. I think... it's wrong to generalise like that. I'm sure there's some real nasty people.
But there are also some probably nasty poor people as well, aren't they?
Yes. Mm. And, you know, it's not about money, I don't think. You've got to be happy as well. That's kind of important.
Mm. And has money made you more happy, less happy, or is money and happiness unrelated?
I know, I think they are related. You know, it's allowed me to do things that I wouldn't otherwise have been able to do that make me happy.
Mm. Like?
Like, you know, going to Grand Prix that I wouldn't have gone to and just the kind of places you're able to visit, the people you meet. I wouldn't be meeting those people. I wouldn't be living in Monaco.
Mm.
You know, what took me there in the first instance was I used to read about the Monaco Grand Prix and I was desperate to go there. And when I went there, I thought, this is a fabulous place. When I can afford it, I'm going to live here.
Right.
But then people think that the plan is you go there to avoid tax. It's not. That certainly wasn't the driver. And as I said earlier, if you want to have your big car and you want to have a nice house and you want to eat out nice, you're paying a lot of tax anyway. Mm. So
they just get you one way
just
or another.
A different way. Yeah.
Okay. Right. This is the cheeky one. I've warmed up for this one. Right. Has anyone ever propositioned you because of your wealth?
What do you mean by proposition?
I was intentionally vague with that word. Like, have you ever been asked out or has someone randomly asked you for something because they know you're wealthy and successful?
Oh, you quite often you get approached because, yes. Lots of times.
Wow. All right, well, we're all going to get rich then. All right, great. So best advice you ever received, and you can do even quicker fire if you want.
The business that you're in is the best business to be in.
Worst advice you ever received?
I suppose not to do some things that I've done, you know, and in fact, maybe not to go to university. You know, I was told not to do that. I had a good job and a good future.
Mm. Okay. Now, on podcasts, there's a common question which says, what advice would you give to your younger self? And I want this podcast to be unique, so we've spun it on its head. What advice would you give to your older self? Like maybe, you know, you're only a couple of years away from the end of your life. What advice would you give to him?
Well, do what you're happy doing, you know, and spend time with people that you enjoy being with.
Mm. Lovely. Is there one thing that's wrong in the world that you would like to change or see differently?
Yes, governments and democracy.
Mm. Enough said about that. That's a whole nother podcast. Okay, and then finally, this podcast is called The Disruptive Entrepreneur. And I always like to ask every guest, what's your definition of a disruptive entrepreneur or that word?
Well, I think it's a lot of what we do, you know, taking over businesses is thinking about them a different way and being disruptive. You know, you're thinking the opposite or quite different from the way people are looking at a particular business problem. You come in with something off of left field to everyone else.
Yeah.
And you've got to have the tenacity to keep pushing to break everything up so that you can put it back together again.
Mm. Well, look, on behalf of everyone on the live and the podcast and us, I just want to say a huge thank you, Jim.
Okay, I hope it was okay.
Well, I've had a lot of fun, so thank you very much. Too. Thank you.